To the list of weird sounding words of the digital age, like Googling and tweeting, we can now add pinning, as in Pinterest. That's a website that's a bit like an online scrapbook or bulletin board. It's become one of the fastest growing networking sites on the internet. NPR's Teresa Tomassoni examines the phenomenon.
Last month, over 10 million unique visitors signed on to Pinterest. But some of them, like Billy Winburn, are still trying to get the hang of it. At an office in Alexandria, Virginia, Jennifer Folsom, who works a few desks away, is walking him through the process.
So are you on there now? You have an account, right? Mm-hmm. And are you following anyone?
No, people are following me. Actually, I'm following one or two people, but I don't know why.
But Winburn did find an architect on Pinterest.
So anything that he likes, I know I'll probably like as well.
Right.
But it could be something new, different, and exciting.
And that's the point. Like-minded people find each other on Pinterest to share ideas. They pin things they find around the web to their online pin boards. Wooden watches, wedding dresses, leather iPad cases. Then anyone that follows them can see what they've pinned and vice versa. It's a place where you can save and organize things you'd otherwise have to tear out of a magazine or file away in your email. Folsom says this way you never lose track of them.
It's all in the cloud, online, organized, sort of wherever I am.
Like Folsom, most Pinterest users are women, and many of them, including Folsom's girlfriends, can't stop talking about it.
We had this hilarious incident in the Jonathan Adler store where my friend said, I've seen that chair. I like it. And the other one said, I think I saw it on your Pinterest board. Wait, it's not pinned there. So she whips out her camera, and she takes it, and she pins it, you know, as we're shopping.
On breaks during the workday, Folsom pins away too, using both her laptop and her Pinterest mobile app.
That might be people's recipes I like or style I admire, whose organizational skills astound me, like this one right here.
She points to an immaculately organized pantry on her laptop. She found it scrolling through Pinterest's endless array of home decor photos. Then she pinned it to her home design bulletin board. On her party time board, she pins a photo of Arnold Palmer Jello shots poured into lemon slices.
That would be a great idea for summer barbecue. Well, I don't know Jana Braswell, but I'm following her because she looks like she has a good time.
That sort of online interaction with people you don't know is an emerging trend in social media.
At first, it was a lot about how many friends do I have, how many friends can I get, how many groups can I join.
Susan Ettlinger, an analyst from the Altimeter Group, says that's changing. Now, people want to connect with others who share similar styles and interests.
It doesn't necessarily mean that we're best friends or that we're even connected on Facebook or anywhere else, but it means that these are people that I learn from and that, you know, and who also maybe learn from me.
Ettlinger says this shift is what's really fueling Pinterest growth. 2 years ago, when the site was launched, Pinterest hardly made a peep. Now that Facebook included a Pinterest app on its new timeline, the company has a potential audience of over 800 million people. But, Ettlinger says, it's worth watching to see if Pinterest holds on to its new users.
Once people start to use it, then you really see whether they come back or not. So we really need to wait probably another, I would say, at least 6 months before we see whether this growth is sustainable.
One question is how Pinterest is making its money. The company declined an interview for this story, but their website offers this much. Entrepreneurs and venture capitalists have helped fund the company thus far, and advertisements may be in line for the future. After all, it is one of the top five referrers of web traffic to retailers. Amy Rutherford runs a home furnishing boutique right above Jennifer Folsom's office in Alexandria.
I'm getting hits to my website from Pinterest, and that's actually increasing exponentially as, you know, as people are adopting Pinterest.
Hits haven't translated into sales yet. Still, she thinks the exposure is good. So every day, Rutherford pins items from her store, and she recommends her customers use it too.
A lot of people don't know what their style is, and when they use Pinterest, they can start pinning things that they see on blogs or on the site itself, and they go back and visit what they've pinned, and they realize that they have a style.
Even if that style's a borrowed one. Teresa Tomassoni, NPR News.
And now some car news. Japanese firms dominated the Consumer Reports annual automaker rankings. Mazda zoomed into the top five, knocking out Ford. As NPR's John Itzde reports, Subaru claimed the top spot.
Subaru replaced Honda on top based on overall performance and reliability. Honda slipped to number 4. Jake Fisher, senior automotive engineer at Consumer Reports, says Honda was hurt by a number of its new entries, including the new Civic.
The Civic was, you know, it's the quintessential small car, supposed to do everything well, and they redesigned it, and it's not even nearly as good as the old model that went out.
The redesigned Subaru Impreza replaced the Civic as the top-ranked small car. Meanwhile, after recently penetrating the top 5, Ford fell back to number 10 because of problems with its touchscreen infotainment system and power shift automatic transmission. Fisher says that left U.S. carmakers well behind the leaders.
Because of some of their older product lines, a lot of their new entries from Ford, from General Motors, especially Chrysler, have been really very impressive.
The Ford Mustang placed on top as the best sporty car. The Chevy Avalanche was Consumer Reports' choice as top pickup truck. John Idstey, NPR News, Washington.
The search for intelligent life in the universe has long been the realm of hard science. It requires massive million-dollar telescopes, advanced degrees, and the ability to use really complicated words.
Talk to me, guys.
Partially polarized set of moving pulses, amplitude modulated.
We're locked. Systems check out, signal across the board. What's the frequency?
4.4623 gigahertz. Hydrogen times pi. Told you.
Strong sucker, too.
I got it! I'm patched in!
All right, let me hear it.
That's from the 1997 film Contact, starring Jodie Foster, based on the book by Carl Sagan. Until now, most of those wanting to join in the hunt for life out there who didn't have a PhD were left to toil alone in their basements, fussing over ham radios and poring over grainy photos of possible UFOs. Well, citizen scientists, you just got promoted. The Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence Institute, also known as SETI, is relaunching its website so that anyone can scour the data coming from outer space and help look for signs of life. I'm joined by Dr. Jill Tarter, an astrophysicist and director of the Center for SETI Research. Dr. Tarter, welcome to the program.
Hi, Audie.
First, start by telling us how this new website would actually work.
Well, people will actually be able to look at raw, real, live data coming from the telescope. I don't think it will be quite as exciting as the clip that you just played, but in fact, people will see signals. They will actually be able to tell us about them, describe them, and if we decide that these are signals that we haven't seen before, then we'll follow up on them in real time, and people will be able to participate in that follow-up as well.
And, of course, this is going to give people access to information from, I believe, the Allen Telescope Array. Can you tell us a little bit about this? Is this radio signals or light signals? What exactly will these citizen scientists be looking for?
Well, in the SETI Live application, it is radio signals that are being detected by the Allen Telescope Array. And our equipment, actually, is looking at a vast amount of data. And only a tiny little bit of it will actually be sent out to the citizen scientists. The parts of the spectrum where there are so many signals that it literally confuses our search system. So we want people to help us describe them, classify them, and keep track of whether we've seen them before.
Now, Dr. Tarter, over the years, have you felt any sort of shift in how the public perceives this mission of looking for signals beyond Earth? And do you think it's changed in terms of there are people out there who have criticized it and it's been the subject of ridicule at times? And will this project make a difference?
Well, it certainly is something that people have ridiculed in the past. But actually, the thing that's changing right now, and it's a huge paradigm shift, is exoplanets. So we now know about thousands of other planetary systems out there. I actually know where there are planetary systems, and that's where we're pointing the telescope.
Is there any time when you have doubts and that you question your mission?
Well, I always have questions, and I don't know the answer. But I'm fundamentally convinced that this is as legitimate a question as how did galaxies form and how old is the cosmos? And I just am totally thrilled by the fact that I happen to be alive in the first generation among thousands of generations which have asked this question And suddenly, we have the tools of the astronomer to try and answer the question by doing experiments rather than asking the priests and the philosophers what we should believe.
Well, Dr. Jill Tarter, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome, Audie.
Dr. Jill Tarter, astrophysicist and director of the Center for SETI Research, talking with us about the group's website, SETI Live. That's SETILive.org. The site relaunches tomorrow, and it will allow citizen scientists to help sift through mountains of data in the search for intelligent life. Dr. Tarter spoke with us from the annual TED Conference in Long Beach, California. It's a gathering of big thinkers from the worlds of technology, entertainment, and design.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And the arrival of spring in one part of Canada brings with it an unusual business, iceberg harvesting. Every spring, icebergs break off of Greenland and float south across the Atlantic to the Canadian island of Newfoundland. For residents, they're as ordinary as snow with some special qualities that can be blended and brewed to make a pretty mean drink. Emma Jacobs reports.
The year the Kitty Vitty Brewery started brewing beer with iceberg water, a giant iceberg floated up against the cliffs around the Newfoundland harbor of St. John's.
It was a big berg, and it jammed right across the harbor here.
Charlie Reese says Newfoundlanders have a curious relationship with icebergs. On the one hand, they're just a fact of life. On the other, when that iceberg was in the harbor mouth, hundreds of people came down to gawk. He took pictures.
And eventually the wind and waves broke it up into small pieces and it just disappeared.
On land, in a former fish processing plant, Reese's brother was already brewing up the first batches of iceberg beer, now a brewery staple.
For the crowner, we put the crown on the bottles, or the cap, the crown we call it.
Reese shows off the assembly line that fills thousands of bottles with the lager by the hour.
We'll go over and we'll take one right off the line and open it up for you.
Perfect.
We got an opening set. Right off the line, fresh.
The ice formed tens of thousands of years ago from compacted snow. That means there are no minerals and that there are lots of tiny bubbles trapped inside. It gives the golden beer a special, very light taste. Newfoundlanders have known about icebergs' special properties for years.
You don't taste anything, right? It's not like normal ice cubes, which even with filtered water, you still do get some, you know, you don't notice that you're drinking chemicals, but you are, right? It's just pure.
Tak Ishiwada says the drinks are just a new twist on a very old Newfoundland tradition of keeping a chunk of iceberg in the freezer. Ishiwada's mother had a block she would chisel pieces off of with a screwdriver to ice drinks. The trapped air in the ice gives off a special fizz in the liquid. Today, Ishiwada runs a sleek restaurant, Newfoundland Japanese Fusion. A couple of years ago, he had the chance to go out in an ice harvesting boat. It's dangerous to get too close to the giant towers of ice, he says. So to break off manageable pieces, he took a shot at the iceberg with a .22 rifle.
It was pretty cool, yeah. Like one bullet took down, it was a minuscule amount compared to this entirety of the ice, but it was big. Big pieces blew off, waves everywhere.
Ishiwada stored the bergy bits, as they're called, that he brought back in his restaurant freezer. He chipped off pieces with a knife to top off special blue martinis. He said they looked like miniature icebergs floating in the glass. And the drink became so popular, he's had to bring it back every summer since. Though he gamely says he doesn't know what all the big fuss is about. He says a lot of people who come looking for the drinks are probably tourists.
They're pretty intrigued with the whole iceberg situation. We find it pretty normal here. So.
For NPR News, I'm Emma Jacobs.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. In Texas, federal prosecutors have indicted seven people in a massive health care fraud scheme. The group, led by a doctor, defrauded Medicare and Medicaid of nearly $375 million. From Dallas, NPR's Wade Goodwin reports on what the government says is the largest scam ever tied to a single physician.
The alleged scheme was audacious. According to the indictment, Dr. Jacques Roy, a Canadian who moved to Alabama and then to Texas, first recruited a web of home health care agencies. Then these agencies would go door to door and sign up patients. Some of the people who filled out forms got cash, some got groceries or food stamps, some were promised free medical services. Some apparently were signed up without their knowledge. Deputy Attorney General James Cole.
The indictment alleges that Dr. Roy's company, Medistat, consisted of just four doctors and approximately 15 nurses. Yet, for the 5 years covered by the indictment, Dr. Roy's company is alleged to have certified more Medicare beneficiaries for home health services and had more beneficiaries under its care than any other medical practice in the country.
That would be 11,000 individual Medicare beneficiaries who either got services that were not medically necessary or, in many cases, never rendered at all. The indictment details how Dr. Roy and his nurses would go down to Dallas's state-of-the-art homeless shelter called The Bridge and try and sign up the homeless. The Bridge security guards and staff eventually became suspicious and informed Roy and his staff they could not see or treat or sign up patients in the Bridge courtyard nor on the sidewalk outside the facility. But prosecutors say that didn't stop them. They simply rented a room at a church down the street and steered the homeless there. Deputy Attorney General Cole said it was quite an operation, thousands of people moving through these HHAs, all leading to Dr. Roy and his collaborators.
These services were provided by more than 500 home health care agencies, or what are called HHAs. In turn, these HHAs and Medistat are alleged to have fraudulently billed Medicare for more than $350 million and Medicaid for more than $24 million.
The alleged conspirators were said to be living the good life in Rockwall, a suburb of Dallas on Lake Ray Hubbard. Beautiful houses, big boats, nice cars, but they are facing the prospect of spending the rest of their lives in federal prison. Wade Goodwin, NPR News, Dallas.
Ben Bernanke is testifying before a House committee today about what the Federal Reserve has done to help the economy. The Fed's powerful Open Market Committee decided last month to keep short-term interest rates near zero. That's about 18 months longer than planned, and they've already been really low for several years. As NPR's Annie Baxter reports, there's a lot of debate about the benefits and costs of the Fed's policies.
The goal of the Fed's low interest rate policies is to juice the recovery. Those low rates should make it easier for people to borrow money, which they'll hopefully spend. The increased demand for goods and services is then supposed to translate into more hiring. That's what the Fed is banking on right now. It hopes low interest rates will help with its mandate of achieving maximum employment. But it also has another mandate, to keep prices stable.
In many cases, those two objectives conflict.
That's economist Joe Gagnon of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says you can understand the conflict of the Fed's dual mandate with this analogy. Imagine you've got a big family and you need an equally big car to cram them all into.
You also don't want to pay a lot for gas, so you want a fuel-efficient car. But the largest cars tend to have the worst fuel economy.
Gagnon says you often have to trade off between the two.
And this is the same for the Federal Reserve. When they try to push the unemployment rate down, in other words, to increase employment, to get the economy to grow faster, that can raise inflation, which jeopardizes their stability goal.
Gagnon thinks the Fed can safely do both at once. It can try to help the labor market without stoking inflation. In other words, it can get a big car with good gas mileage. But critics of the Fed's current policies disagree. And some of those critics come from within the Fed system. The president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, Narayana Kocher-Lakota, has voted against the Fed's easy money policies because of the inflation risks they pose. He's not currently a voting member of the rotating committee that makes decisions on interest rates, but his concerns about inflation persist.
We're going to have to pay some costs in terms of inflation if we're going to go down this path of using accommodative monetary policy to go after long-term unemployment or try to bring people back in the labor force who are not currently in the labor force.
Kocher-Lakota worries that inflation could climb above the 2% range the Fed deems acceptable, as it already has during the recovery. A big, sudden jump could send the Fed scrambling to raise rates.
The concern is that if you go down this path, that you're going to see realization of inflation that will trigger a lack of trust in the central bank's ability or willingness to keep that 2% target. The cost you suffer is the loss of trust.
I do think there's a danger to the Fed's own credibility right now.
Robert Dye, an economist with Comerica Bank, notes that short-term rates have been near zero since 2008. To keep them low for another 18 months is, in his view, unprecedented. Among the groups harmed by low interest rates, Dye notes, are savers, who can't get a good return on deposits. And other problems may not even be discernible yet.
The longer we're in an extreme position here relative to historical patterns, the more we risk these unforeseen and unintended consequences.
One such consequence could have to do with the message the Fed is sending about the economy. It's keeping rates low because the recovery is still weak and needs a boost. Dye and other economists say that vote of no confidence could by itself be harmful. Annie Baxter, NPR News, St. Paul.